content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian Magazine. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll pick back up where we left off reading about Anne Exdell Morris with an article titled The Land of the Ancient Ones by Richard Grant. And this is all about Anne Exdell Morris gets her due in a movie created partly on remote tribal lands the pioneering archaeologist studied nearly a century ago. Cuerte Voorhees, who's the director, producer, writer of the film, wanted to shoot all his Canyon de Shelley and Canyon de Muertos scenes at the authentic locations in Arizona, but for financial reasons, he had to shoot most of them elsewhere. The state of New Mexico, where he and his crew are based, offers generous tax incentives for an in-state film productions, and Arizona offers no incentives. This meant that a double for Canyon de Shelley National Monument had to be found in New Mexico. After extensive scouting, he decided to shoot on Red Rock Park, outside Gollup. The scenery is on a much smaller scale, but it's made of the same red sandstone, eroded by the wind into similar forms, and contrary to popular belief, the camera is an excellent liar. At Red Rock, the crew worked late into the night with uncooperative horses in rain and wind that turned to slanting snow. Now it is mid-morning, and snow flurries still whipping across the high desert. And Laurie, sure enough, the living image of Anne Morris, is rehearsing her Navajo lines with Taft Blackhorse and his son Sheldon. During a break, I asked Laurie how she prepared for the role of Anne Morris. I read her books. She's a brilliant writer, and a lot of her personality comes through, she says. I tried to research her, but there's barely any information online, which seems extraordinary. I had a long Zoom call with her grandson Ben, which was really helpful. And I have my accent coaches, one for Anne's Nebraska accent, which is very flat, like the land there, and Taft and Sheldon for the Navajo, which is really difficult. Laurie finds it tragic that such a brilliant woman ended up in her 40s as a broken, pain-racked alcoholic recluse. She's glad the movie doesn't dwell on that. We do address her decline, but our film is really a celebration of Anne, so we focus on those amazing years she had in the 1920s, she says. And she did have an impact. Those books are out of print now, but they were very influential in their time. Anne was inundated with letters from people who wanted to become archaeologists, and she really paved the way for other women in the field. The filmmakers managed to recruit the British actor Ewan Bremner to play the archaeologist Sylvanus Morley, and the great Cherokee actor Wes Studi, who delivers a blistering performance as Solly, the crew boss on the Morris excavations. Perhaps the greatest casting coup, however, was to persuade Jonathan Nez, the 46-year-old president of the Navajo Nation, to portray the time-traveling incarnation of the Anasazi. With the weather still bitterly cold and windy, Nez arrives at the set in a black SUV with a small entourage and ducks into a trailer to get into 1920s period costume with a double layer of thermal underclothes. I asked him why he decided to participate in the movie. To represent our people and our belief system, which is sown through the scene that I'm going to be a part of, he says. Anne is sick, and we believe the ancient spirits made her sick. If you disturb the negative energy, it comes back to you. That's what she did when she was excavating. You don't mess around with this stuff, and she's messed around with this stuff. For the Diné who know her story, there's no mystery at all to Anne Morris's sickness and early death. In her excavations at Canyon del Muerto, she broke one of their strongest taboos with entirely predictable consequences. You don't do that, explains Nez, who studiously avoids using the words dead and death. That's why there are very few Navajo archaeologists. Taft Blackhorse is one of them, and after handling dead bodies, he goes through a purification ceremony to remove the danger from the spirits. Ron Maldonado, also observing the shoot, was an archaeologist for the Navajo Nation for many years. He is not Navajo, but his wife and children are. To protect them from the chindi, spirits of the dead bodies he disturbed, he went through a ceremony that required him to spend 4 days covered in sheep fat and charcoal. The movie presents the Navajo explanation for Anne Morris's sickness, and it also presents the Morris family explanation. Anne and her brother were born with weak bones and the arthritis of the Axtells. Anne Morris died in self-imposed solitude at the age of 45, and the official cause of death is unknown. Earl Morris married again to a school teacher, and he never spoke of Anne again. In my family, we kept her buried under layers of pain and shame and silence, says Gil. It was like the Navajo death taboo. Don't talk about her or something terrible will happen. Now with Anne rescued from obscurity, embodied in her youthful vivaciousness by Abigail Laurie, and celebrated on screen by a writer-director who genuinely admires her, Gil hopes that his grandmother will finally get the recognition she deserves. It's been an excavation, he says. We've dug down through the layers of shame and silence. We've exposed the prejudice she had to deal with. We've brought her out into the light. Next, we'll move on to an article titled Blues in a Minor Key by Jim Boges. Jimmy Holmes is the last in a line of musician legends. At his Mississippi juke joint, he goes all out to keep a singular American art form alive. On a pale morning in Bentonia, Mississippi, a village of 400-odd souls, one of the few signs of life are the half-dozen pickup trucks parked or idling outside Planter's Supply, the local feed and seed. The Blue Front Cafe sits at one end of the street, next to the rusted husk of a former cotton gin, and across the railroad tracks from a string of long shuttered storefronts and sagging rooflines. The rumble and clanging of boxcars fills the cafe as I take a seat across from the proprietor, Jimmy Duck Holmes, who at 73 is the last in a line of bluesmen from Bentonia. Holmes swings his left leg over his right knee, revealing a scruffed, dusty black loafer. He's dressed in black pants and a gray hooded sweatshirt. His gray hair sneaks out from underneath a black cap. Holmes's parents opened the Blue Front in 1948 to serve hot meals to townspeople who labored at the cotton gin or on the surrounding farms. By night, there were moonshine parties and impromptu performances by local musicians, who played a distinctive style of blues unique to the Blue Front and other juke joints in the hills between the Big Black and Yazoo Rivers. But the Blue Front, where legends such as Nehemia, Skip Jones, and Jack Owens played in the 1950s and 60s, was the most famous, the grand old Opry of the exotic Bentonia sound. Today, it's thought to be the oldest surviving blues joint in Mississippi. You got a lot of used-to-bes. That building used to be this. That building used to be that, Holmes says. This is the last juke standing that's still in operation. As a boy, he helped out around the restaurant, which still serves sandwiches and hamburgers most Fridays and Saturdays. Along the way, he learned to play the Bentonia blues from its pioneers, and for a long time it seemed possible the style wouldn't survive him. Then came the internet, which made it possible for countless people to discover and wonder about and even learn this music. This place and what it represents draws fans from all over. The blues front and the music that goes along with it still exists. Spirituals, field hollers, and African rhythms evolved into blues music over many years across the American South. But the Dockery Plantation, at its peak a 40-square-mile tract in the middle of the Mississippi Delta, wouldn't be a bad choice if you had to focus on one point of origin. It was here, 90 miles north of Bentonia, that a handful of sharecroppers, Charlie Patton, Robert Johnson, and Howlin' Wolf among them, pioneered the art form. Delta blues is widely considered the original blues template, an acoustic country blues distinguished by slide guitar, as popularized by Patton and Johnson. Another widely familiar style, Chicago blues, is an urban, electrified version of the Delta blues, and it grew out of the Great Migration. After Muddy Waters, Howling Wolf, and other rode the Illinois Central Railroad north out of Mississippi. Hill Country Blues is an upbeat, twanging strain that grew out of the hills and hollers of northern Mississippi. Most songs that could be called the blues despite the melancholy name, are set to the bright, cheery tones of major key chords, and they can convey any emotion or situation the performer wants to express. Bentonia is a strange, more ominous idiom. Its unsettling sound hinges partly on a guitar player's spidery finger picking, which frequently requires the use of all 10 fingers. Perhaps most important, the bentonia style is played in a minor key tuning, making it sound tense and dark, with repeating motifs and ringing open strings plucked without a hand on the fretboard. The result is a droning, hypnotic character. And unlike the comforting, predictable 12-bar blues most people are familiar with, think of Hound Dog by Elvis Presley, or The Thrill Is Gone by B.B. King, bentonia blues has a loose structure. There is no chorus, no set number of times to repeat a musical pattern. The overall effect is spooky in a way, but really beautiful, says Dan Auerbach, frontman for the blues rock group The Black Keys, whose Nashville-based recording label Easy Eye Sound produced Holmes' 2019 album Cypress Grove, which was nominated for a Grammy Award. Despite playing guitar for decades and living just 30 miles south of Bentonia in Jackson, Mississippi, I hadn't heard much about Holmes until his 2016 album, It Is What It Is, showed up in my mailbox courtesy of the record label. In Holmes, I found an uncompromised version of the blues, led solely by the artist's vision. The sound best heard on a dusty concrete floor or a front porch, away from stages and lights. Music, in other words, not showbiz. At the Blue Front, Holmes presides at live music performances. Some nights as the only performer, others as MC for other performers. When Holmes sits at the microphone, his leathered, contemplative voice draws out stories he may be singing for the first time. "I don't write down lyrics," he told me. "They could say, we're going to do this line again, we're going to do this line again, or let's just do this one again." That was it. Scholars of the blues trace the bentonia style to Henry Stuckey, whose life is as mysterious as the music he innovated. He was born at the end of the 19th century, and according to an interview he gave in 1965, the year before he died, he tuned his guitar according to the style of a group of black soldiers from the Caribbean he met while serving with the U.S. Army in France during the First World War. Like most blues musicians of the era, Stuckey was also a farm laborer, and he lived with his family of six within the South Delta or nearby, in communities like Little Yazoo or Satartia. For a couple of years in the mid-1950s, the Stuckeys lived on the Holmes family farm in Bentonia. "He would play to entertain me and my siblings and his kids on Friday and Saturday afternoons," Holmes says. "I would see that particular counter was planting the seed in me to start playing the guitar." Holmes is one of the only people still living who knew Stuckey. Stuckey never recorded music, but he passed his songs and playing style to a handful of others, including Skip James, the best-known blues artist from Bentonia. The wider world first heard James' finger-picking style in high, lonesome falsetto on a series of recordings for Paramount Records in 1931. James was paid $40 and became so discouraged he stopped performing and lapsed into obscurity. But interest in those scratchy 78 RPM records grew, and 30 years later, James appeared at the 1964 Newport Folk Festival in front of 15,000 people. The performance was the talk of Newport, providing an exotic, rural counterpart to the electrified blues made popular by artists such as B.B. King and John Lee Hooker. James went on to record several sessions that were released on the albums Today and Devil Got My Woman. After a 1966 session in Los Angeles, James told the producer, a UCLA grad student named David Evans, about another Bentonia bluesman, Jack Owens, who had also learned from Stuckey. "Jack Owens was kind of a country version of Skip James," says Evans, a musicologist now retired from the University of Memphis. "Skip's playing was a bit more refined or artistic. Jack was more rough and ready and played more for dancers." Holmes was a close friend of Owens and describes him as a moonshiner who buried his money in bottles in his yard and fashioned an abandoned corn crib into a juke where he played and sold his hooch. He couldn't read or write and didn't know the names of the notes he played, which contributed to his unorthodox style. Owens, in turn, saw Holmes as a successor to the Bentonia tradition. When Holmes's father died in 1970, he took over the Blue Front, and he continued to organize performances of local musicians. In 1972, Holmes and his mother founded the Bentonia Blues Festival to showcase them. In time, Owen started urging Holmes to get more serious about guitar himself. He would come every day and say, "Boy, let's play," Holmes recalls. "I think now, from a divine perspective, he wanted me to learn it, but he didn't know how to teach it," Holmes says. Owens also encouraged Holmes to be rigorously honest in his own music and lyrics. "Your lyrics have to be true to what you were singing about. Whether it's hard times, good times, wife done left, or you got drunk, it has to be true. And I could gather what he's saying. If you're not doing it truthfully, it's not going to work out." Owens continued to perform at the Blue Front and at festivals until his death in 1997. For his part, Holmes didn't record until age 59. A St. Louis-based label called Broken Hungry Records put out Holmes' first two albums in 2006 and 2007, and an Oxford, Mississippi label, Fat Possum, put out another in 2008. Auerbach of the Black Keys brought Holmes to Nashville to record him in the studio in 2019. Holmes has lately taken on the role of educator, lecturing about Bentonia blues to schools and civic groups in Mississippi and elsewhere, and teaching musicians. The festival that he continues to produce in Bentonia each June has become a week-long showcase featuring touring blues artists, including artists Holmes has taught. Robert Connolly Farr, a Mississippi native who absorbed the Bentonia style into his heavy, thunderous groove. Ryan Lee Crosby, who brings influences from Africa and India to the Bentonia sound. And Mike Munson, a Minnesota native who plays like Jack Owens, Holmes has said. Holmes says Owens was more concerned with teaching the Bentonia style to him than it necessarily seeing it grow. "He never gave me the impression he wanted me to learn it to pass it on. But Holmes, a natural teacher, is determined to see the tradition continue and evolve." Recordings by Farr, for example, who is now based in Vancouver, British Columbia, Bentonia standards like Cypress Grove and Catfish Blues are menacing, guttural, speaker-rattling blues, far removed from Holmes's subdued acoustic interpretations. For Holmes, the blues allows and even celebrates change and welcomes the imprints of individual artists. Farr recalls something Holmes once told him. "You're not going to play it like me. You're not going to play it like Skip or Jack Owens. You're going to play it how you're going to play it. That's the blues." A couple of weeks after my first visit to the Blue Front Cafe, I drive up Highway 49 again from Jackson, this time with my guitar, prepared to learn some of the secrets of the Bentonia style from the last bluesman who watched Stuckey play it. Inside, a fire in the wood-burning furnace has taken the chill out of the room. I set my guitar case down on the concrete floor next to a card table and pull up a metal folding chair. A few Miller Lite empties from the night before sit on the table, in front of vinyl records and CDs of Holmes' music for purchase, and a large jar with tips scrawled in felt tip marker on a strip of duct tape. Over the entrance to the kitchen hangs a ghostly photograph of Stuckey cradling a guitar, dressed in white pants and shirt and a matching fedora, standing alone in a field with the late afternoon sun elongating the shadows behind him. Holmes picks up his Epiphone acoustic guitar, and I tune down to him one string at a time, a ritual he performs with everyone who sits in with him. He begins by showing me how to play Silent Night in an open D minor tuning, although in truth there's little to identify it as the traditional Christmas hymn, apart from the lyrics and a suggestion of the original melody. He's a patient teacher, but a hard man to impress. On the jam that turns into Cypress Grove, Holmes stops me and repositions my fingers as an inch-long ash dangles from the cigarette in his free hand. He knocks a rhythm on the body of his guitar to help me pull the licks of All Night Long into shape and shows me a few of the licks and patterns that are central to Bentonia blues. Several times I realize, as we build upon what sounds like a new pattern, that Holmes has taught me the root riff of a recognizable Bentonia standard. When I finally latch on to the slow groove of Catfish Blues, Holmes offers encouragement. "There you go," he shouts from behind the counter where he's just rung up a customer. You're catching on real good. Working over the chord progressions during our lesson, I remember something Holmes had told me. For some reason, blues lyrics are labeled as hard times. Lonesome, poor, poverty, he says. Blues lyrics are not all based on hard times. He was echoing a lament I'd heard from players such as Chris Stone, Kingfish Ingram, a 22-year-old guitar prodigy from Clarksdale, Mississippi, about how blues isn't popular with young audiences because it's so connected to the past and the horrors of slavery, sharecropping, and Jim Crow. But the longer I practice, the more I understand how the simple act of playing this music can provide a respite from those burdensome legacies and might, for some, even feel like an act of liberation. They were singing about something good or bad, Holmes said that day. The more they sing about it, the better they feel about it. They'll keep repeating the same thing over and over because they rejoicing. I'm so glad my baby's coming home. So glad I don't have to be alone. You follow me? When the lesson comes to a natural conclusion, after a little more than an hour, Holmes takes a seat at the cafe table and unmutes a television mounted above the front door. The sound of steel guitar strings is replaced with chatter of cable news channel. As I pack up my guitar and head for the door, the teacher stops me. When are you going to come back again? Next, we'll move on to an article from the prologue section, National Treasure this week, When Time Stopped by Angela Saratori. A watch belonging to an American crew member points to the final chaotic hours and minutes aboard the Titanic. The first thing you notice is that the watch is handsome. The gold case engraved with an elegant filigree, a fine script announcing it was made by the Elgin National Watch Company. It's a watch befitting its respected owner, John Starr March of New Jersey, who in 1912, at the age of 48, served as mail clerk aboard the Titanic. March's wife had died in 1911, and his two daughters implored their father to look for a job on dry land. It's easy to imagine that having lost one parent already, they wanted to hold on to the other. March was no stranger to drama on the high seas. In 8 years working in ocean liner mailrooms, he'd been involved in no fewer than 8 separate nautical emergencies. But the Titanic assignment was apparently too good to pass up. A chance to run the mailroom for the greatest ship ever built. Next, you notice the rust-colored stains on the watch's white face. Signs of water having seeped beneath the glass, and the black hand slender, the larger with a delicate metal decorative accent, showing the time as 1:27. What a tale those hands tell if you recall that the fateful collision on April 14th, the Titanic striking an iceberg in the North Atlantic on its maiden voyage, occurred at 11:40 p.m. The 883-foot-long ship plunged beneath the surface less than 3 hours later at 2:20 a.m. Some 1,500 passengers and crew died, and 705 survived. So, 1:27. Inevitably, we wonder what March was doing in the hour and 47 minutes after the Titanic struck and before his watch stopped. The cost of building and operating such a ship, says Daniel Piazza, a curator at the Smithsonian National Postal Museum, was too great to cover with passenger fares alone. So the giants of the White Star and Cunard lines carried mail, maybe 1 million individual pieces on any given voyage. Aboard Titanic, there were 5 postal clerks and a fully operating mail sorting facility, a rarity since ocean liners more typically carried closed mail bags from one port to another. Among other things, the Titanic's sorting facility allowed passengers to send postcards and letters when it docked in Ireland and France. Mail clerk might sound like a menial occupation, but it was in fact a plum assignment. You had to pass a test and only the top percentage would qualify for this sort of job, says Piazza. And they were paid accordingly, he says, with salaries somewhere between $1,000 to $1,500 a year, which is a lot of money in 1912. In the hierarchy of the ship's crew, the mail clerks were somewhere in the middle. Initially, they were housed in third-class quarters and expected to take their meals with that group. But after some protests, they were moved and given a private dining room. On the evening of April 14th, they had gathered to celebrate the 44th birthday of another American mail clerk aboard, North Carolina-born Oscar Scott Woody. Ship's officer, who rushed to the mailroom after it became clear the vessel was in serious trouble, later told a Senate hearing investigating the disaster what he saw. I looked through an open door and saw these men working at the racks, and directly beneath me was the mail hold, and the water seemed to be then within 2 feet of the deck we were standing on, bags of mail floating about. Like the chamber orchestra, which reportedly continued to play until just before the ship sank, March and his colleagues apparently performed their duties amid the chaos and tried to save as much mail as they could. Piazza suggests that they would have started with the registered mail, and indeed, the survivors later reported seeing clerks hauling mail bags up to the deck, evidently in an attempt to keep them dry until help arrived. Help did not materialize until after the ship went under, of course, and in some accounts, people huddling in lifeboats later reported seeing mail bags bobbing in the inky black water. In 1985, oceanographers located the wreck some 13,000 feet below the surface, and over the years, salvage operations would recover countless Titanic artifacts, dishes, jewels, pieces of the ship itself, many items eagerly purchased by collectors on the private market, as well as 340 bodies, including that of John Starr March. He was buried in Hillside, New Jersey, with USC Postal Service RMS Titanic engraved on his headstone. His watch was returned to his two daughters and is now in the collections at the National Postal Museum, a small gold tribute to a man who did his duty until his time was up. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.